We wanted to look tonight at the perfect church. I want us to think about this and think about how we can strive to be like the perfect church. A lot of times when we think about the perfect church, we know that in God's design, in His plan, He intended the church to be perfect. His blueprints are perfect. The church, if it followed all of His commandments, would be perfect in every way. But as we look at the churches in the New Testament, we find quite a different story, don't we? We find churches that are plagued with one problem or another, or several problems, and they seem to be churches that are struggling and that constantly are having to be corrected. And we can feel with them for that because we know that's been our experience in our century as well, that we haven't been able to find a perfect church. In spite of the fact, did you know there's the perfect church in Atlanta? I had no idea. I was searching for a picture to use and search for perfect church, and there's one in Atlanta. So if you ever want to know what the perfect church is like, you can go to Atlanta and find the perfect church. Well, the fact of the matter is, I don't think it's probably very perfect either. But as we think about it, so, you know, people, well, even when we talk about, well, we need to be striving for this ideal of perfection, this ideal of the church that God intended it to be. People say, well, which church? Which church do you want to imitate? All the churches in the Bible have problems, so which one are you going to imitate? Well, yes, that's true, they all had problems, but the blueprint certainly was the perfect thing. But I want us to take a look at one church that, while like others, it was not perfect in the sense that there was no problems and that it was sinless and full of sinless people, but it was perfect in the sense that it was reaching maturity. It was complete. It was striving for what God wanted it to be. And as we do that, we want to think about this church. Particularly, we're looking at the church at Philippi. Again, it wasn't sinless. Not everyone there was a perfect Christian. The church itself wasn't entirely perfect. But as we look at the details of that church, we find that they were doing the things that, if continued, would bring perfection. So let's look at the beginning of the church in Philippi, and that's where Dick read just a little bit ago from Acts 16. Paul sees the vision, come to Macedonia. And we could have a whole lesson from this passage as well as a few others on the implication of something, because the Bible doesn't, according to the Bible, the vision that he saw just said, come over to Macedonia and help us. How did he know he wasn't supposed to take them food? He understood the implication of this vision, that what they needed was the gospel. And that was what his help would be if he took it to them. So he gets to that city. On the Sabbath day, they go out, they find a place where some women are praying. And they study with Lydia, and they baptize her and her whole household, and then she urges them to stay with her. And they stayed with her while they continued to preach and teach. A little later on, after casting a demon out of a fortune-telling girl, the masters of that girl were not happy, and they wound up in prison. And then, of course, we remember the earthquake, and they were loosed from their bonds. And the jailer wakes up, and he thinks that it's the end because he's let those prisoners escape, that he was told, don't let these guys out of your sight. So in chapter 16, down in verse 28, Paul calls to him and says, don't harm yourself, we're all here. And the jailer called for lights and came in, brought them out, and says, sirs, what must I do to be saved? Paul, of course, tells him he needs to believe in Jesus, and then he goes and teaches him about who Jesus is, and the jailer washes their wounds and is baptized that very night. And then at the end of the chapter, in verses 39 through 40, they come to apologize because they have beaten Roman citizens without having a trial, and they know they could be in serious trouble for that. But then they went, so they are asked, you know, go your way. Well, they get out of prison, they go back and visit Lydia again, and then they see the brothers and then encouraged them all, and then left. This is the beginning of the church in Philippi. Not exactly what we would picture as the ideal way for a church to get started, and yet it is a good way for the church to get started in this situation. It worked out well for the church there. And we see a little later on the building up of that church as it continues to grow in Acts chapter 20 and verses 3 through 6. There he spent 3 months when a plot was made against him of the Jews. He set sail for Syria and decided to return through Macedonia. Sopater the Berean, son of Pyrrhus, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus and Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy and the Asians, Tychicus and Trophimus. These went on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas, but we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days we came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days. So here Paul made another trip back through Macedonia and spent some time there in Philippi as well again, and then went on to Troas as well. So as we see this church that started with just Lydia and her household, the Philippian jailer and his household, and others apparently began to become a part of this congregation, we want to notice some things about the church at Philippi and what it was that made it a special congregation. They were certainly special in Paul's heart. Not that he didn't care for other churches as well, but this one was special to him. And I want us to think about this, because we want to be a church like Philippi in a lot of ways. There are a lot of things about Philippi that are good for us to notice and pay attention to. So first of all, the church at Philippi was pressing on. They were moving forward. They weren't stagnant. They weren't drawing back or pulling back or giving up or anything like that. They didn't have a siege mentality of, well, we'll just hold out till we die. You've probably all been to congregations somewhere where that was the mentality. Well, we're going to die. You know, the church here is going to die out, but we'll hold on till we die. That was not the attitude that the Philippian church had. They had an attitude of, we're marching on, we're pressing forward. Philippians 1 and verses 9 through 11. Paul says, "It's my prayer that your love may abound more and more with knowledge and all discernment, so that you may approve what is excellent, and so be pure and blameless for the day of Christ, filled with the fruit of righteousness that comes through Jesus Christ to the glory and praise of God." And then in verses 25 and 26, he says, "Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and the joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again." So Paul wants to come to them again, but he also wants them to be able to see progress and joy in their faith. He wants them to press on. He wants them to grow. He wants them to continue on and abound more and more in their love, with their knowledge. And the indications are that they were doing that very thing that he encouraged them to do. Secondly, the Philippian church was edifying one another. Philippians chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Paul says, "Therefore, my brothers, whom I love and long for, my joy and crown, stand firm thus in the Lord, my beloved. I entreat Euodia and I entreat Syntyche to agree in the Lord. Yes, I ask you also, true companion, help these women who have labored side by side with me in the gospel, together with Clement, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life." They had worked together. They had labored together. They had built up the church. It's interesting. All of these people that are mentioned here in Philippians 4, none of them are mentioned in Acts 16. We don't know who they are or how they became part of the church there at Philippi. But Paul is encouraging them to get along, make their agreements together, don't be striving with one another, don't be fussing and fighting, be of one accord. And he encourages this true companion. Some translate that as an actual name, which it may very well be. But asks, help these people. And he mentions Clement. These people who were fellow workers with him. Wants them to be edifying one another. And that's something that we too should be doing. Are we going to have times where we disagree about how things should be? Yes. That's perfectly natural for two human beings to not agree on every single thing in life. But how do we handle it? Do we fuss and fight? Tear the church up? Or do we get together and come to an agreement and an understanding? And that's what Paul called on them to be able to do. We also see that the church in Philippi was rallying behind mission work. They were supporting missions. They were a mission themselves from the beginning, but now here they are helping other missions. Philippians 4:14-18, Paul says, "Yet it was kind of you to share my trouble. And you Philippians yourselves know that in the beginning of the gospel, when I left Macedonia, no church entered into partnership with me in giving and receiving except you only." The Philippi church was the only one in the whole area that gave to Paul's work to help him go forward with his work. He goes on to say, "Even in Thessalonica, you sent me help for my needs once and again. Not that I seek the gift, but I seek the fruit that increases to your credit. I have received full payment and more. I am well supplied, having received from Epaphroditus the gifts you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God." These folks cared about missions. They cared about missionaries. They cared about Paul's work in spreading the gospel. And they supported that work. They sent someone with gifts to take to him. On at least two occasions when he was in Thessalonica, they sent him help. They were supporting him, rallying behind the mission work that he was doing to spread the gospel. And a perfect church is going to be doing that. A mature, perfect church is going to be doing these things that we're talking about. They were faithful consistently. Now notice, they weren't perfectly sinless, but they were faithful consistently. I'll ask the husbands and wives out here. Is it possible for your spouse to be consistently faithful to you and yet not be perfect? I think most of us would agree that we haven't found the perfect mate anywhere. None of us have. But faithfully consistent. Consistently faithful. Standing by your side. That's what you want. Even though they're not going to be perfect. They're going to have their own failings. They're going to have their own weaknesses. But to be faithful is more important. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27. He says, "Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel." And then in chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, he says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only as in my presence, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure." This was a church that was consistently faithful to Christ. They weren't sinless. They weren't perfect, but they continued to be faithful. And when Paul called on them to obey, they obeyed. And now he's calling on them to do so, even though he's not there anymore. But he says, even in my absence, keep obeying. Then we also see that the church in Philippi was evangelistic. The mature church is going to evangelize. Philippians 1, verses 3 through 6. Paul says, I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. They were partners in the gospel, spreading that gospel, sharing it. Remember, we talked about those that are mentioned in chapter 4, and those are names that weren't mentioned in the account in Acts when the church was established. These were some who had been converted. These were some who had been taught and brought to Christ. And a mature church will be evangelistic, reaching out to others. But then we see that the church in Philippi was committed to working. They weren't lazy. They were hard workers. Philippians 1, 6 and 7 says, And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. It is right for me to feel this way about you all, because I hold you in my heart, for you are all partakers with me of grace, both in my imprisonment and in the defense and confirmation of the gospel. Chapter 2 and verse 13 says, For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Now again, the working that they were doing, it wasn't of their own. It wasn't they were just coming up with their own things to do. God was working in them. God was working through them. And He was bringing about His good pleasure. And then in verses 25 through 30 of chapter 2, Paul says, I've thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother, and fellow worker, and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. For he has been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. So receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. Now I know this is just one individual. This Epaphroditus is just one person. But he was sent from Philippi to help Paul and to serve Paul and to take gifts to Paul. And Paul says he nearly died for the work of Christ. That tells me something about the congregation he came from. Generally speaking, and there may be some exceptions out there, but generally speaking, hard workers don't come from lazy families. They come from hard-working families. Hard-working Christians don't come from lazy churches. They come from hard-working churches. And I think it's an indication that Philippi was a hard-working church that sent Epaphroditus to be a hard worker for Paul and with Paul, even to the point that he nearly died for the work. And Paul was certainly concerned about them being concerned about his health as well. But they were committed to working. They helped with the work financially. They helped with the work by sending others from their congregation, from amongst themselves, to do the work. They worked. They were trained to maturity. Philippians 3, verses 15 and 16, Paul says, Let those of us who are mature think this way. Now, Of course, he said, well, you're pulling that verse from its context. Yes, because I don't want to have time to read the whole section there. But Paul's talked to them about how they're supposed to be thinking and what their mindset is supposed to be. And he says, those of us who are mature, we've been trained to this point of maturity, we're going to think this way. And if in anything you think otherwise, God will reveal that also to you. Only let us hold true to what we have attained. So he said, you've attained some things, you've been trained, you've been taught, you've reached a level of maturity. You may not know everything. He said, if you think differently in anything, God will reveal that too. You'll still keep growing. You don't know everything yet. But what you do know, hold on to it. They had this level of maturity in the church there. Then we see also that this church is incredibly benevolent. Now, we've already seen the cases of that with them sending gifts to Paul in Thessalonica twice and through Epaphroditus on another occasion, that most recent one, and now Paul's sending Epaphroditus back. But they have been supportive of him all along the way. So much so that Paul actually brags about them to another church in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 5. Now I'm going to tell you that he doesn't just brag about Philippi, and he doesn't mention Philippi by name, that congregation. But what he says there in 2 Corinthians 8 is, we want you to know, brothers, about the grace of God that has been given among the churches of Macedonia. Now remember, Philippi was the chief city of Macedonia. So Philippi is one of these churches. He says, for in a severe test of affliction, their abundance of joy and their extreme poverty has overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For they gave according to their means, and as I can testify, and beyond their means of their own accord, begging us earnestly for the favor of taking part in the relief of the saints. So not only did they support Paul as a missionary, but they found out about the needy saints and they begged Paul, please let us help too. Now this was a group of people, he says, who were in extreme poverty. And that they were still saying, let us help with this. He says, this was not as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then by the will of God to us. They were incredibly benevolent. They were like the widow that Jesus talked about who gave her mites, that gave the last that she had. They were in extreme poverty. They weren't just writing a check because, well, I've got extra money this month I don't know what to do with. They probably had to skip a meal or two to give that money that they gave in order to have it given to the others who were needy. They were incredibly benevolent, so much so that Paul's bragging about them and the other churches in their area to the Corinthian church, trying to encourage the Corinthian church, which apparently seemed to be more a wealthier church, to do likewise and give like they had promised to do. But then we see also that the church at Philippi was organized fully. Philippians 1:1, Paul and Timothy, servants of Christ Jesus, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi, with the overseers and deacons, or bishops and deacons, your translation may say. The elders and the deacons. They had elders, they had deacons over the work there. They weren't just a brand new church anymore. They had reached this mature point where they were organized as the Scriptures teach. And they were being led by overseers and had deacons serving the church in those ways that they needed to serve. Another mark of a mature, complete congregation. And then we see that they were never inhospitable as far as the Scriptures reveal. In Acts 16:15, as soon as Lydia was baptized, she immediately invites them, stay with me. Let me feed you and give you a place to stay while you're preaching and teaching the Word. And then in verses 33 and 34, the Philippian jailer, Even before he was baptized, he went and showed his repentance in his heart by washing their wounds that they had received from being beaten. And then, after he was baptized, they all came back and they were rejoicing. They brought him back to the house, him and Silas, and set food before them. In the middle of the night, got the food out of the refrigerator for a midnight snack after the baptism. And then, of course, rejoiced that they believed in God. And then, of course, in verse 40, after being in prison and being released from prison, you know, a lot of folks, "Oh, it's fine, I met you, I let you, but oh, now you've been to jail. I don't know, that's a little sketchy now." But not Lydia. She invites them right back. They come and they visit with her again. And then they see the rest and they encourage them. So they're not discouraged, even by Paul being arrested and imprisoned and beaten. That doesn't discourage them from still showing hospitality to him. So as we think about all of these things, the church here at Blue Ridge should strive for perfection. Strive for maturity. In some ways that we've looked at and we say, well, we already do a pretty good job of this one or that one. But we need to look at those areas where we're not measuring up, where we're falling short, where we're weak, and strengthen those areas and grow in those areas to reach that full maturity. We need to be doing the same things that the Philippian church was doing to get to maturity. There were things they had, you know, the pattern hasn't changed. The same things that they were doing are the same things that we need to do. We need to be pressing on. Not hunkering down or cowering in fear or backing off. We need to charge forward. We need to be edifying one another. We need to continue rallying behind missions. We need to be faithful consistently. We need to be evangelistic, reaching out to the lost in our community and throughout the world. We need to be committed to working. We need to be trained to maturity in these areas. We need to work toward being incredibly benevolent and being organized fully and never being inhospitable. And if we'll do those things, then we can reach perfection just like the Philippian church did. If you're here tonight and you've struggled, you've allowed yourself to get caught up in all of the things that keep us from reaching maturity, if you have a need to correct those things, maybe you've seen weaknesses in your own life where you're not living up to the mature level of a Christian, and you need to grow in some areas, and you need the prayers of the church to help you to grow and to help you to reach that mature level. If you have a need to respond for any reason, please do so as we stand and sing.